Okay, well, great. Well, thanks very much. We really are delighted to have Fred Moll here today. You know, implicit, if not explicit, in every single solitary innovator's workbench program that we've done has been the question of how far technology can go. You know, what are the limits in terms of delivering greater clinical value? And I think nothing kind of captures the full picture of where technology horizons go, like robotics. And tonight we have with us, obviously, the person who has done more to make robotics a reality than anyone, and that's Fred Moll. So, Fred, let me begin. I spent a little bit of time just on your early career, because a lot of the folks who've been here got the bug very early, either in terms of medicine or engineering, and kind of knew early where they were headed. But you are a doctor by training, but fought for a while the inclination to go into medicine. Give us a little bit of your early background on how you got to medical school, because I think that's an interesting part of the story.
Sure. So I grew up in Seattle and was the son of two pediatricians and some pretty prominent physicians in Seattle, and shuttled off at an early age to Lakeside School, and was introduced to a very academic community in Seattle, and where, you know, schooling was my job, you know, my number one job, and there wasn't much else that I really was supposed to be concerned with. And that sort of came to a screeching halt sort of in the middle of high school when my parents passed away, one by a sailing accident and another by a coronary. And I think I implicitly sort of decided, you know, I want to get as far away from my past as a way of dealing with sort of those events in my life, and went to Berkeley. The last thing on my mind was, I want to go to medical school. Mm-hmm. And you know, Berkeley in the mid-70s was a pretty interesting place. And so I didn't take a lot of science. I didn't take a lot of classes, actually. I decided that Berkeley was interesting, but the rest of the world was probably more interesting. And so I worked very hard to graduate in 3 years by going to summer school and taking an extra class the driving force behind that being, you know, get in, get out, and go do something more fun. And so,
and you spent a year doing what when you graduated?
Skiing in Sun Valley, Idaho, which is still probably the greatest year of my life. But somewhere in there, I stopped sort of fighting my past and stopped sort of fighting the influence I think my parents gave me that, you know, medicine is important. You know, patient care is a great thing to be involved with. And, you know, I don't know when it happened, but I slowly kind of came around to the idea of, you know, I would love to go to medical school. I'd love to be a doctor. Everything else seems less compelling, less important, less valuable. And so I had to go back to school. I actually went back to Dartmouth College to do organic chemistry. Mm-hmm. And in an intensified course in the summer, we got all of organic chemistry done in one summer and almost killed me off. But then I came back to Seattle, and you know, the most obvious destination for me for medical school was, as a resident of Washington State, was the University of Washington. So,
did you have an aptitude for it? When you had to go back and take the science, because you had studied economics and English, did you have an aptitude for it, or did you find that you had really to overcome the fact that you had not spent a lot of time in the sciences and the medical
You know, I was always area. A pretty good student. I was never, you know, the best student, and so I had an okay aptitude for it. But, you know, in medical school, you know, especially in that time period, you know, it sort of separated the men from the boys intellectually. And, you know, never forget, in medical school exams, my best friend in medical school literally in a 3-hour exam would walk out in 45 minutes, and I'd be racing to finish it in 3 hours. So, you know, I had an aptitude. You know, it was pretty good. It wasn't, you know, wasn't the best. So,
so you I don't know if you glossed over very quickly, but your parents were prominent in pediatrics, and your residency was in pediatric surgery. What do you think drew you to surgery?
So I struggled with, you know, sort of the logical thing was, well, gee, my parents are pediatricians. Maybe I should get involved with that. You know, that, you know, on the surface of it, wasn't that appealing? Pediatric surgery sounded a lot more interesting. And so I focused on surgery, because you can't enter pediatric surgery. You enter either a surgical residency or a, you know, medicine residency. And so opted for surgery, but really struggled with you know, that was in the time period where radiology and interventional radiology sort of a new concept. And I think maybe the seed of the idea that there was going to be sort of less invasive approaches to treat disease was just sort of gelling in my mind. And that and so I did seriously consider going into interventional radiology as opposed to surgery, and I struggled with that all the way up to the final match program where you need to say what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And finally decided that I, you know, I couldn't spend most of the rest of my life in a dark room looking at shadows. And so so I opted for surgery and entered a local surgery program in Seattle.
So very early on, you said to me that you began to look at this new kind of movement toward less invasive, minimally invasive laparoscopic surgery, and realized that a lot of it was being done in gynecological surgery and not that much in general surgery. Talk a little bit about that and why that to you seemed to be an unusual thing. I mean, maybe just gynecological surgery was the best place for it.
So, you know, I feel very fortunate that, you know, to be here and have had the opportunity to get involved in minimally invasive surgery and be involved in the progression of technique. And I think a lot of the reason why, you know, I was able to do it was I was in the right place at the right time with the right people. And it was absolute happenstance. It wasn't that the institution was necessarily focused on minimally invasive surgery. It was a couple of gynecologists that were, for, you know, those times were very aggressive in laparoscopic technique. General surgeons, of course, didn't have anything to do with it. Most gynecologists, as far as they'd go at that time, was they'd do a tubal ligation. And that was about all they were willing to do with a laparoscope. And yet, there were two gynecologists at the hospital that when you rotated through the gynecologic service would push you to think about, see, what else could you do with laparoscopy? And I really took the bait. I mean, and why I took the bait, I don't know. But I think that was the point I really found a passion. And I, you know, I get asked a lot, gee, what was wrong with surgery? You just really didn't like it. You left. And it absolutely was not that. It was a passion for one particular thing, which is, why wouldn't a general surgeon want to do less invasive procedures via laparoscopic route? What's wrong with that idea? And the more I was told, and I tell the story a lot more, I was told by, you know, chiefs of surgery, well, Fred, you don't understand. It doesn't matter how big an incision you make. Wounds healed side to side, not top to bottom. It doesn't matter how big an incision you make. I was, you know, willing to kind of go, you know, I know he's smarter than I am. He knows a lot more about surgery, but I'm not sure that's right. And so was willing to take a bit of a walk on the wild side and say, gee, what would it take for a general surgeon to get interested in a gynecologic technique? And my take on it was not exactly right, but it was something that sort of led me down the path I've taken, and which was, they're probably not, you know, no self-respecting general surgeon, I hope there's not any gynecologists in the audience, there's no self-respecting general surgeon is going to adopt gynecologic tools to do surgery, because, mm-hmm. you know, there's just a difference there. And so the idea of creating tools for the general surgeon for laparoscopy sounded like the most fun thing I could think about doing in a time period where a lot of people take a research year. And I, rather than take a research year, I said, gee, what if I sort of stepped away from the residency, went into the lab and wasn't sponsored by the institution, but worked on a variety of tools that might represent modern laparoscopic technique that a general surgeon might consider using, and at the same time period, trying to figure out a way to raise money to maybe start a company to do this. Because, as I said, my take was a general surgeon has got to be presented with a set of tools that he or she is willing to use to do surgery, and they didn't exist in gynecology. And I didn't know a damn thing about business, but I was smart enough to figure out that you got to have something to sell in order to create a business, in order to sustain a business, in order to do interesting things. And so so I thought about sort of what does laparoscopic surgery lack at its core? What does it use a lot and doesn't work very well? And that was sort of what got me onto this idea of the world needs a better trocar. And for those of you who don't know what a trocar is, it's the way you gain access through a puncture wound into the abdominal cavity. And when I first started thinking about it, what existed at that time was essentially a big, long, German-made steel spike that you rammed through the belly button and hoped you didn't hit anything bad. And literally, I mean, some people still do it today, and it's just amazing they get away with it. And in fact, there's a certain incidence of, you know, vascular injury, bowel injury, death, associated with trying to gain access via laparoscopic technique. So the idea was, gee, isn't there a better way to do that? And can you convert that tool that is used in every puncture you make to from a steel spike that needs to be resharpened every 3 weeks to a disposable instrument that can be sharp every time and be safer? And so that was sort of the germination of the idea of the safety trocar, which turned out to be a pretty good idea and fit very nicely with sort of a standard set of tools that could be transformed from reusable to disposable and create a business that looked more like U.S. Surgical, which was sort of the, you know, high-flying story at the time, rather than a Storz or a Wolf or some other, you know, reusable company.
So I'll save my question for a little bit because I could save for then. So you have this idea, which I think is an interesting leap of faith, that you wanted to develop new tools and wanted to build a company around it. Talk about your first experience in trying to raise money in Seattle and how that led you to launch Endotherapeutics.
So it was brutal. you can turn the clock back. There weren't any venture capitalists in Seattle. There was one. There was a firm named Cable House and Cozad. And they heard the story and scratched their head and didn't know what to make of it. So I knocked on every door I could. I was actually lucky enough to have a father-in-law-to-be that was a very influential guy in the community and said, you got to talk to this guy and you talk to that guy. And so I did all that. Also, interestingly, was introduced to a guy named Grant Heydrich. When, I don't know, Russell, if I ever told you this story, but Grant Heydrich in 1983 knocked on my door at Virginia Mason Hospital and said, somebody told me to come over here to hear what you're doing. And I told him all about, you know, my view of how the world was going to adopt laparoscopic surgery for general surgical procedures. People were yanking out gallbladders, and it's a brand new world. And he sort of scratched his head and said, you know, great story. I'm probably pretty junior, to present this to my group, my team. And he had just changed venture firms. But we kept in touch, and Grant and then Russell and others have had been a big part of my progression from, you know, days of a trocar to Hanson Medical.
But fill in the pieces in between, because I think the experience you went through early on was really instructive. You had joined with an engineer, Carver Anderson, to help you actually create the device.
Yeah.
And the VCs one of the VCs in Seattle suggested that you go down to Sand Hill Road here.
So yeah.
And find someone who'd fund you there.
Yeah. So and the only guy in the room that can attest to the truth of this story is George Murphy, who's was the second employee of Endotherapeutics, and who I haven't seen in at least a decade. And appreciate you coming, George. So I was really frustrated for 9 months trying to raise money from every way I possibly could, and I finally was introduced to someone in Seattle that said, well, I wouldn't touch this. There's probably one guy in the world that would touch this. There's this guy named David Ramler, and he's on Sand Hill Road, and he's a venture capitalist with Vanguard Associates. And so I flew down, and was immediately struck. I mean, David Ramler, probably very few people here remember him or knew him, but he was an interesting character, you know, in good ways and in bad ways. Extremely bright, could sort of wow you with his intelligence, but didn't have a lot of background in venture capital. He didn't really know what he was doing, but he convinced me.
You didn't know what you were doing.
I didn't know what I was doing. And so he said, look, here's the deal. I'm going to give you, I'm going to fund this company, and I'm going to put $150,000 into this company. And I went, that's more money than I ever heard of. And he says, but as you said, you know you don't know what you're doing. I know you know you don't know what you're doing. So you move down here. I want you in my backyard. I want to, I want to watch your every move. So I moved down, and the experience was, was quite an adventure to try and raise money. And I felt, I can't express the feeling that, if I pack up my Fiat and drive to California, knowing that I had funded a company and it was a big adventure. It wasn't, the greatest funding source in the world, quite frankly. And, Jay Watkins, who I had, met shortly after I moved down, said, who had also worked with David Ramler and had, had a sort of plus minus experience, said, and Jay's extremely articulate guy who can, dissect, summarize a situation in a few words and be absolutely correct every time. And his description of David Ramler is, you just got to understand that this guy operates under the theory of a theory of life that if he is going to win, you are going to lose. So all of a sudden, the last few years made perfect sense to me.
And in fact, George Carver Anderson did not survive
So it was, I was oblivious to it, but it was a very, it was my first real lesson in the number one objective of venture capital is conservation of equity. And the easiest way to conserve equity is to fire a founder before you give him equity. So he had two founders, and he didn't like that equation. So he said, Fred, we need you. That guy, we'll invite him in later. So why don't you tell him to stay in Seattle till we call him up, And so it was a mistake of mine. But I had to have the heart to think Carver,
So Endotherapy was launched in 1984.
Yeah.
And you soon run into a guy who made David Ramler look like Gandhi, and that's Leon Hirsch from U.S. Surgeon. How did Leon come to the picture?
George and I and others began this process of building a disposable trocar and a disposable varies needle and testing it clinically, putting it in a package and trying to sell it. And it was tough sledding. And believe it or not, our ASP, I think, going out the door was around $12 or something absolutely ridiculous. And I remember being at the Houston Texas Medical Center speaking to a gynecologist, and I was detailing, because we all got out and tried to sell a disposable trocar to a gynecologist, which is, even at $10, pretty tough, tough equation. And the guy looked at it, because it's very novel, but I have to actually spend an extra $12 in a procedure to use it? And I said, yeah, that's, he says, I don't think I can do that. You know? And so, you know, it was clear, you know, we were okay at product development. We weren't that good at sales. So I'm not sure how it happened, but Leon Hirsch heard of the Trocar and sent his minions to check it out, and then one day drove up in a white limousine and came in and looked at it and said, yeah, I think we want this. And so then we went through this horrendous negotiating a period where we thought, again, naively, that we were going to sort of partner with U.S. Surgical to develop the laparoscopic business. So the minute the deal was done, he lost our phone number and started developing the Trocar himself and selling it, and we were the recipient of a royalty stream, which actually was astounded everyone at the rapidity of which it started growing when U.S. Surgical was actually able to start selling it, as opposed to, you know, our tiny entity. And so it was a lesson in sort of, you know, sometimes in the medical device business, you know, the product development is the easy part, selling is the hard part.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The question I was going to ask before and maybe appropriate now is that you made an interesting leap of faith, which is that the reason why general surgeons weren't doing more laparoscopic surgery was because they didn't have the right tools, rather than the reason being that because there was a cultural resistance on the part of surgeons to do closed procedures rather than open procedures. Did anything ever convince you that, I mean, it's in the success of the safety Trocar and the revolution in minimally invasive surgery, which that would usher in, absolutely confirmed for you that you were right, that it was about the tools and not about the culture. But did that ever occur to you that you were betting on something which some people might have said really was a cultural issue, that general surgeons just don't want to do closed procedures?
So this is what I bet on. The compelling logic of if you can do a procedure through a puncture wound, it just isn't, it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can do it safely and you can get away with it and you know, there isn't some aspect of it that represents, you know, a wildly different cost, different or a safety risk, that it's got to happen no matter how much resistance. And there was enormous resistance to laparoscopic anything in the general surgical community. People thought it, and I'm sure a lot of people know this story, but people fought it fiercely for years and years and years. And the logic was, you know, was so compelling. And so, you know, the data was so overwhelming about the difference in morbidity. Even early on, it was, it was startling how long it actually took. So my bet was, you know, if you boil it down, is the logic overwhelming or not? And it truly was. And, you know, in fast forward to Intuitive Surgical, it was sort of the same bet. That is the logic, you know, of being able to give back to the surgeon capability that they lost in open surgery, is that an overwhelmingly logical proposition? Yes, it is. Now, is it going to be hard to do? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's probably going to be really hard to do. But if you're willing to fight the fight, you're probably going to win at some point. You don't run out of money.
So before we get to Intuitive, you have this notion that what was going to drive minimally invasive surgery was better tools. Why did you leave endo? I mean, it seems like it's obvious, but why did you leave endo? Because your departure from endo led to the creation of Origin with Jay and Al Chin, who's here. Tell us the story of how Origin, why you left.
So I left endo because we had been sort of hoodwinked by Leon Hirsch, who said, you know, we're going to work with you, we're going to make a big company, and then he lost our phone number, and he's selling our product, and we kind of sat back and said, wondering what the royalty stream's going to be this month, you know? And so I said, I'm probably not advancing, you know, my career, and sort of, you know, I learned a lot about product development, learned a lot about business, but still believe that there's a lot more to learn about business. And so,
were you making as much money, more money than you ever thought you would, or were you disappointed in the financial arrangements as well? You said the royalty stream.
Yeah, I mean, there was
huge.
No liquidity event. It had happened yet. I mean, yeah, the royalty stream was coming in, but you know, there wasn't, you know, that wasn't being distributed. We're still trying to build a business, but it had lost its focus. We didn't, you know, it was sort of a in a sense, a restart or a sort of a company that exists for, you know, a cash flow for somebody else's product. And so it didn't feel like I was, you know, going where I wanted to go. And so I said, well, you know, I did pretty well for not knowing a damn thing about business. What if I actually knew something about business? And so I enrolled in this institution in the Sloan program, which is the one-year business school option, spent a year here. And, you know, people ask, you know, sort of what was the impact of that year? And, you know, it's interesting, business school is something that, you know, people ask, if you had to do over again, would you have done it? And I sort of, at my age and stage and what I wanted to do, I'm not sure I would have, but, you know, did meet a great group of people, learned sort of the more of the language of business, and got incrementally smarter. And, you know, it gave me a sort of a pause to think about, you know, what to do next. And so I got out of business school right at the time, or actually it was a couple months before this guy, Eddie Joe Reddick, did his first gallbladder.
Out of Georgia.
And I heard about it because that was sort of my, you know, I kind of go, someday, I know that's going to happen. You know, I wish I could have done it, but I wasn't in the position to do it. But I, you know, built the tools. I'm sure it's going to happen. You know, certainly was able to do it in the lab. And so heard about, you know, his first case, which actually turned out to be wasn't the first case. But called him up and I said, and the one thing that I always struggled with in laparoscopic cholecystectomy is how do you retract the liver in order to get access? And it wasn't obvious to me, even doing labs, that you know, there was an easy way to do it. And I called him up and he said, well, you just, you know, you put the patient in Trendelenburg, you grab the gallbladder and you head north. And, you know, okay, you know, simple solution, hadn't occurred to me. And so I got out of business school just at the time laparoscopy was, you know, or laparoscopic cholecystectomy was just starting to take off. And I said, okay, and I spent, a lot of money I kind of didn't have to go to Eddie Joe Reddick's first course in Tennessee where you did laparoscopy on rabbits. It was hysterical. And he was selling laser laparoscopy, which, you know, was sort of marketing thing. And so I participated in that. I came back and I called up my friend Grant Heidrich and I said, you know, I'm a free agent and I'm you know, looking around for what to do next. And he said, you know, you ought to go talk to this guy that I've put some money behind. He's got an office on Sand Hill Road and he's creating a company and it's a great story, but it doesn't have any products. And he's writing a business plan for a company that's going to take surgeons' ideas and turn them into products. I go, okay, well, I'll go talk to him. And that was Jay Watkins. And went to Jay's office. And, you know, I showed up at 2 o'clock. And he breezes in at 4 o'clock and says, oh, well, you Fred? Oh, okay, well, hey, I'm going to go to a presentation at a venture firm. I'm going to talk about this concept I have for a new business. And you're welcome to come along if you want. I said, okay, well, I got nothing else to do. I'm not working. So I went and we presented to an old Leiden venture firm in, on Page Mill Road, the ones that funded FedEx, and I can't remember, but that walnut paneled boardroom. And these guys sort of dribbled in, sat down, kind of wondered what they were doing there. And Jay gets up and starts to lecture on, you know, the state of the medical device industry and where it's going. And everybody, what the hell is this guy? And by the end of 45 minutes of a lecture, everybody was like this. And so I said, I'm with him.
So you had started Endo with the thought that there's at least one tool, and I know that Endo also developed a needle that was necessary. Did you come out of that experience thinking that there's a whole bunch of other stuff?
Yeah, so I met Jay, and he had, you know, all the ability to raise money for a company and, as I said, no products. And so that's where I came in, that's where Al came in. Mm-hmm. And Al came in with an orthopedic product, and I came in with a boatload of ideas on laparoscopy because, you know, I knew as much about it as anybody else on the planet at that point because it was so new. And so we did both. And we built an orthopedic product and a series of laparoscopic tools. Fortunately, one of which incurred the wrath of my old friend Leon Hirsch. And so we built products, and before we were ever able to introduce them, we were slapped with an injunction. At the same time, we were trying to sell the company to Eli Lilly. And so it was an interesting time. And,
so you, at some point you got Ron Dolans interested. How did that come about?
Yeah, so Jay, you know, and give Jay full credit for this, you know, Ron Dolans was running around the Silicon Valley looking for the next billion-dollar opportunity for Eli Lilly, because it wasn't Guidant yet, it was Eli Lilly. And he was tasked from Von Bryson to look for an opportunity the size of angioplasty. And laparoscopy looked like that opportunity. And, you know, Jay's perception of the situation was, why wouldn't they be interested in acquiring a company that has innovative ideas in laparoscopy, somewhat of a track record in being able to deliver innovation, and you know, a pretty good pedigree of people that, you know, were had surgical backgrounds and or, you know, good business backgrounds. And he sort of pushed that relationship, and Dolans bit, and we went through this process of due diligence that you know, that pitted a couple of different companies against each other, one of which was Eli Lilly, and showed, you know, ran a series of pig labs that showed potential new laparoscopic technique. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, we're going to take a flyer on this, and bought Origin. And so we all ended up working for Lilly. And it was just about the time in when Hillary Clinton started going out the pharmaceutical business. And so, yeah, sort of 1992-ish, Lilly was getting nervous about its future in pharmaceuticals and decided to shed its participation in the device business and wrap it up into Guidant. We were lucky enough to be invited to the Guidant party along with ACS and DBI and CPI. And so we all ended up working for Lilly for a limited period of time, and then became part of the Guidant corporation.
What happened to, so you say, it's smack in the middle of the due diligence, U.S. Surgical slaps you with an injunction claiming what?
Claiming that I built a trocar in my, you know, endotherapeutics that they licensed together with improvements. Mm-hmm. And the one we built at Origin was an improvement to the old trocar, and they owned it and I didn't. Mm-hmm. And so I had the unfortunate experience of, you know, we sold both Origin and endotherapeutics the same year. And so I was waiting by the mailbox for my second big check from endotherapeutics or from U.S. Surgical, and it never came. And so after, you know, a couple of weeks, I was convinced it didn't get lost in the mail. It wasn't coming. So I called up the corporate attorney of U.S. Surgical. I said, you know, everybody else got paid. What about me? He says, well, you actually owe us more money than we owe you, so we're just not going to send that check. And it was a few million dollars, you know. So what ensued was a fairly lengthy court battle that was resolved at the same time that we were litigating in conjunction with the litigation on the new trocar.
Did you ever get your check?
I did. Took a while, but took a couple of years, actually. Yeah.
So your job at once Origin was part of Guidant was that you were the head of the surgical products group at Lilly looking for new surgical technologies, and that would eventually lead you to Intuitive.
Yeah, I was sort of the medical director for surgical stuff, and my job was supposed to go out and look at, you know, new surgical opportunities that, you know, potentially made sense for Eli Lilly. So I was, you know, along with every venture capitalist on Sand Hill Road, was told to go see what was going on at the Stanford Research Institute, or SRI International, as it's called now. and they were doing telesurgery. They had gotten some money from the Department of Defense, and were trying to develop a technique whereby telerobotics could be used for battlefield surgery, where the surgeon sat in the mass unit, transmitted surgical capability to the field, and accomplished a quicker intervention in, you know, battle in primarily vascular injuries in the field, while protecting, you know, the surgeon by being remote to the actual procedure. And so, which is a, you know, ridiculous use of the taxpayers' money, because then it was, it, you know, they're still working on it. But it did represent one thing to me that was very interesting, which was this fundamental shift from first time I'd ever seen sort of the capability of controlling the tip of a tool electronically rather than directly mechanically. In other words, you're able to take your hand off a direct mechanical connection with the tip of the tool and make that connection electrical. Why would you want to do that? Because then, it was really clear early on that if you could articulate a tip, you could sort of eliminate, in a virtual sense, that big long stick, and you could go from electronic control to tip of tool, and you could give back to the surgeon the capability some of the capability they lost in open surgery. Because the well-kept secret about laparoscopic technique is it's great for the patient, it's a terrible way to operate. Mm-hmm. If you have a big open incision, you're going to do a lot better job this way. And so for those procedures that required the technique of open surgery, you'd like to do in minimally invasive format, it struck me that maybe electromechanical control of a tool could offer, you know, a whole new way of thinking about, you know, how you do laparoscopic technique and, as I say, give back to the surgeons a better technique where you could do more sophisticated procedures because you could suture in a more reliable fashion.
And that's actually an important point, because SRI folks and Phil Green had shown that technology to a lot of folks. And I'm not certain if this is too much of a stretch, but while it remained a story about telesurgery, it didn't really have an appeal. I think what you were able to do is to see that it really wasn't about telesurgery, but as you call it, flexible surgery, because that second generation of minimally invasive surgery past laparoscopic cholecystectomy stopped short precisely because surgeons didn't like the new tools, that didn't like doing the new procedures through rigid tools and through these kind of mechanical interfaces, as you call them.
Well, it's hard, and so you know, there are some laparoscopic surgeons that don't and will never need a robot. But there are not that many of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, there are some magicians, just as there are in cardiology. There are some magicians that can move a catheter in ways that you or I will never be able to do, no matter how hard, you know, how many hours we practice and how hard we tried. So it's not so much that that electromechanical control is necessary for great technique, but you know, great technique in the, can only be obtained, in my opinion, with laparoscopic technique, in the sort of upper echelons of the community of surgeons. And so it really more, you know, is a method of, and we talk about this at Hanson, of leveling the playing field between those exceptionally talented surgeons, as I say, will never need a robot, and those clinicians that truly can be made more precise and obtain better outcomes by better control of tools.
So I'm going to get to the origin, so to speak, of Intuitive Surgical in just a second, no pun intended. But you guys, that's an interesting point, because one of the early pitches behind robotics was that, you know, to paraphrase kind of a marketing term, is it made good surgeons great and great surgeons even better. And it was never clear whether that was as appealing to great surgeons as it seemed on the face. I mean, there was early resistance to robotics among leading surgeons who, frankly, weren't all that interested in making their less skilled colleagues better at what they do.
Yeah, no, there was enormous resistance to it. And, you know, I was the first CEO of Intuitive and, you know, decided that we ought to go after cardiac surgery. And everybody goes, why in the hell did you do that? And in retrospect, it's probably a mistake. But the thinking at the time was that if one can do a coronary anastomosis with a robot and get away with it and do a good job, no one is going to argue about the relative benefits of a robot. If you can do that in a minimally invasive format, because you're sure as hell not going to do that with sticks.
Right.
Or at least most people most of the time sure aren't going to. And it was one way to combat the enormous resistance to why the hell would I want to use a robot to operate? And so I felt, you know, the only way you're not going to do it in, you know, taking out gallbladders. Having said that, you know, I again make the, you know, if my first company would have been a robot and before laparoscopic surgery took off and gallbladder surgery, every hospital would have five of them just because everybody would need to do laparoscopic cholecystectomy, and they probably wouldn't, you know, they probably would gravitate to the easiest way to learn laparoscopic skills because it's not easy, you know, it's a little bit painful. And so the thesis was, if you can set a high bar for this technology and deliver undeniable, you know, call it clinical value or capability that most people most times say can't do that with, you know, it's like you can't do that with a colonite, you can't do that with a manual tool, then you've established, you know, clinical capability.
Go ahead.
Yeah. The problem with that theory was that everything else that goes with a procedure has got to fit so that, you know, yes, you maybe could do the anastomosis, but everything else made the procedure untenable.
So how did Intuitive come about, and how much development work did you have to do to take what you were licensing from SRI to create the Da Vinci robot? And you know, not that I'm sure it wasn't an extremely ingenious engineering feat to create a safety trocar, but the difference, obviously, in sophistication between a safety trocar and Da Vinci seems, you know, to outside observers to be enormous. What was the kind of technological challenge of the Da Vinci?
So when we met SRI, really what they had built was a remote conventional laparoscopic system, because it didn't have a wrist, it didn't have the capability to really, you know, make the maneuvers that your wrist can make if you're doing open surgery. And so the one big challenge is to really put a wrist on the end of the tool and control it in a way that was intuitive. And it's sort of where the name came from. You know, it's great to have lots of degrees of freedom at the tip of the tool, but if you can't, you know, if it doesn't make any sense when you're moving at the console, then it's not going to add value. And so that was the technical challenge. And so they had sort of shown, you know, a very early prototype that says you can move here and it'll happen over there with some precision. But it was still sort of in the format of straight sticks without articulation. And they, you know, they cheated on the three-dimensional vision because they weren't thinking about laparoscopy necessarily in a battlefield. Although Phil had, you know, suggested laparoscopy was one of the applications, they used two big cameras on the outside because they were envisioning being in a mobile OR in the battlefield where you could have stereoscopic vision that was gotten by two cameras, in an open incision. So the two big technical challenges were put a wrist on the device and then figure out a way to stay out of trouble in a situation where you've completely lost tactile feel. And the way we did that was to really make a call fairly early on, actually, after we went to our first very early human clinical trial where we tried to, you know, use the robot in a way with monocular vision, and found that the precision, despite the wrists working well, the precision wasn't good enough to stay out of trouble with regard to, you know, the lack of tactile feel. And so what we found was with stereo vision, you could substitute better vision for tactile feel. And so if you could see the tissue deformation, you can stay out of trouble with regard to not knowing exactly how hard you're pushing. You can estimate visually rather than needing to feel it. And that was a big bet, actually, a big technical bet that, in most cases, most of the time, we could get away with that trade-off because mm-hmm. it wasn't entirely clear that we weren't going to have big problems with that.
So that's certainly filled in this piece, but you like this idea. You brought it to Ron Donald's. Guidant just was not interested at all, and that led to the creation of Intuitive. How did you fund the company? Who funded it, and how much capital did it take
so,
at first?
So I got very excited about it. Went to Guidant, said, you really need to do a robot, build this robot, because it's going to be a great thing. And they said, sort of looking at me sideways, and kind of went, that's about as far away from our core business as we could get, and there's not a chance in hell we're going to do that. And so went back to my friend Grant Heidrich and the Mayfield Fund, and at that time Russell Hirsch had joined them, and they had they were interested in looking at it. Scratched their head a little bit and said, "Gee, we need somebody who's got a good background both in medicine and capital equipment to take a look at this." And that was John Freund, was a consultant to the Mayfield Fund. They asked him to go down and take a look at this thing, mm-hmm. and he came back saying, "It's great stuff, and very interesting. I want to be involved." And so it was a process of extracting me from Guidant via a very creative reverse severance package, and working with Russell and the Mayfield Fund and Grant to fund Intuitive, with John's help of licensing the technology out of SRI. And quite honestly, he did a fabulous job of essentially stealing the technology from SRI.
Given the technological challenges, was there a lot of funding that needed to go into it? Was it expensive to launch Intuitive?
Extremely expensive. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's well over $100 million. Yeah.
What was the reaction of doctors the first time you took the Intuitive concept of Intuitive? I'm not sure any Da Vinci was even finalized, but what was the first reaction when you took that?
So it's interesting. You get a lot of resistance to the idea of using a robot in surgery. Why would I want to do that? What is truly the point? It's a standard response from surgeons. I can pretty much do what I want to do now. I don't need that. But the thing that gave me confidence that we were actually, going to succeed with the technique was that, we had a pretty straightforward demo where you'd give somebody the ability to sit down and stack little rings on top of each other or throw a stitch. And quite honestly, for as much resistance as we got, if we could get a clinician to sit at the console and move the hands and watch in 3D the ability of the wrist to do their thing, I didn't meet one clinician probably met one. The overwhelming majority of clinicians would stand up and say, I get it. I understand what you're doing. I'm not sure I'm going to buy one. I'm not sure I'm going to use it, but I get it. And I think what it taught me was, a lot of it is a challenge of communication. What is the robot really all about? Why would you, is it, okay, so you can be long, do long distance procedures and so forth. And it was really, until you really crystallize the difference between manual technique and robotic technique and what it can offer, nobody got it. And so you had to sit, so we sort of talked about early on in Intuitive, a demo is worth 1,000 PowerPoints because you couldn't internalize it until you used it. And once you used it, usually, people would say, okay, I'm on board, or at least I understand that you're not absolutely out of your mind.
Very early on, robotics captured a lot of people's imagination. I'm certain they were all surgeons.
Yeah.
But in fact, if you go to Intuitive today, there's a montage on the wall of all of the publications, consumer press, that did articles on robotic surgery early on, Paris Match, and a whole lot of publications. And the theme of all those articles was, you know, kind of space age medicine is here. We're going to do. Was that early image of robotics as a kind of space age technology coming to surgery, was that good for robotics dissemination because it raised awareness, or was it bad because it created the wrong kind of impression or sense of what robotics is all about?
No, I think it was not only good, it was essential to the survival of Intuitive. Because quite frankly, we sold systems early on for the pizzazz of space age medicine, be the first on your block, you know, compete
Mr. Hospital with
the hospital down the street. Yeah, I mean, it was absolutely more than half the story. Not to say that, you know, that we weren't, you know, on our way to great things clinically, but unless it caught on in that sense, I think it would have been a much more, I mean, it was difficult anyway, it took a lot of money, but without that sort of initial boost of interest, you know, on a marketing level and a PR level, I don't think we would have gotten there.
So Da Vinci started as a cardiac surgery tool, but quickly switched, or soon switched, to a tool used in prostate surgery. Why did it do that? I mean, what was it that made it work effectively in prostate surgery but didn't catch on in cardiac surgery?
So, you know, I think it's actually, you know, in 2020 hindsight, it's really obvious. Sure wasn't obvious at the time. And I told you why I thought cardiac surgery was the right target. And, you know, we actually spent a long time trying to make cardiac surgery work. And, you know, it does work. Mm-hmm. Certain clinicians in mitral valve surgery, certain clinicians in coronary, doesn't work for a lot of people, or it just hasn't, you know, hasn't penetrated that deeply. And it has penetrated, you know, much, much more deeply in urology. And why is that? And it's sort of back to this, it's a variety of things, but, you know, the simplistic way of looking at it is gallbladders were too easy, cardiac surgery was too hard, because cardiac surgery is very complicated. Gallbladder surgery is very uncomplicated. Prostate surgery has two things. It's sort of medium as far as the complexity of the procedure, and it involves an anastomosis. So it doesn't have all the stuff going on with cardiac surgery. It doesn't have the risk of cardiac surgery. It does have an anastomotic element, which is sort of, you know, to a great degree, Intuitive's reason to be. You can sew really well, and it's really hard to sew that well with conventional laparoscopic technique. So you had to do an anastomosis. You had, it was fairly complex laparoscopy, and so precision was important. And sort of the reason why, you know, I shied away from it early on was I'd scrubbed into a bunch of open prostatectomies, and I couldn't think of a bloodier procedure where it was less clear what was going on, there was more need for tactile feel to kind of figure out where you are and try and avoid the nerves and stuff. So early on I thought, gee, we're going to have a tough time because of the amount of blood that you get, you know, when you get into the venous structures in the pelvis. It's really interesting that, it turned out that because of the risk of bleeding of venous structures and obscuring the view of a laparoscope, what it demanded was meticulous hemostasis deep in the pelvis. And so, you know, you weren't going to be able to do the procedure with a robot or laparoscopically unless you were extremely careful about the dissection and stopping bleeding before it started. So what that demanded was, you know, meticulous technique in a procedure that, quite frankly, wasn't so meticulous in an open format. And so I believe that it, because we were able to zoom in and have great magnification and demand that the clinician, because once you start bleeding and it's, you know, it's sometimes venous bleeding, difficult to stop, you're probably done. So they were scared to death and made sure that they had control of the vasculature and made sure that they were very careful about that, which led to a very precise technique, which led to better, you know, nerve sparing, which led to better rates of impotence and incontinence. And at least, you know, that's my analysis of what happened there. And it was counterintuitive that a very bloody procedure could be turned into, you know, with open surgery, which where you've got all the facility to make it not so bloody, turned into a technique that was much less bloody in a laparoscopic format.
So I want to get to Hansen, and I know we're running up against time, but let me ask you one question about Intuitive. About a year after Intuitive was founded, Lonnie Smith came in as CEO, and by at least one measure, which is, and the company soon went public, and by at least one measure, share price, you would be hard-pressed to find a more successful company than Intuitive has been. You could argue that Intuitive actually has been more successful as a stock play than as a technology play, because the number of installed units is still relatively small. It's still under 1,000. What, to your mind, accounts for the tremendous commercial success of Intuitive?
I think, you know, people bet that growth is sustainable, because they look at the penetration of one procedure and they look at all of surgery and they kind of go, you know, it's probably robotics is here to stay. And it's going to grow, and they've delivered numbers that are, you know, pretty spectacular. And it combined with the fact, and this is, you know, I think half the story, they're a monopoly. Mm-hmm. They have no competition. And, yeah. You know, you can put yourself in that position. Combined with, you know, they have no competition, and you look at sort of who's coming up their back, and there's nobody there. You know, I mean, we sat 5 years ago. We all shuddered at the thought that the Japanese were going to run us over like a steamroller. And
never happened.
What happened to them? Where are they? Why didn't they ever, you know, challenge the business? And the fact of the matter is they didn't. And they may be out there ready to clobber Intuitive, but I doubt it. There's no evidence. There's no competition in the marketplace, and it's gaining traction. So I think, you know, there's a pretty logical argument that says, yeah, it's way outgrown its market cap, but it can grow into that market cap and, you know, potentially could keep going because they have such a head start. And I think, quite honestly, a lot of it is most people say, well, you know, we could go compete in robotics, but, you know, we'd have to go build that thing. Doesn't sound, I don't think I want to do that. You know?
And in fact, ironically, they did a competition, but Computer Motion, but both struggled, and Intuitive wound up buying Computer Motion, and that's how they got to.
Yeah. So, but I think there's another issue, which I think is really important. I think it represents a transition that's going to take a long time for the J&Js of the world to wake up and smell the coffee about the days of, you know, the model for the medical device business being, you know, overpriced disposables shouldn't be necessarily the current model. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the world, you know, has changed that way. And, you know, that electromechanical plays are, like it or not, are going to be a big part of the instrument business. And so it was great to sell a trocar for, you know, a couple of $100 and, you know, make it for $7, sell it for a couple of hundred and, you know, and not have anybody, you know, challenge it. But I think, you know, and there's still those plays. And when you see them and, you know, they're great stories. But I think, you know, J&J could have gotten in early
or U.S. Surgical. And question always is, why didn't they? And that's...
I think they were stuck in their old model. Yeah. I think they wanted to keep, you know, selling.
I was talking to somebody from a product company, telling me I was coming out to do today, and this person said to me, robotics, I still don't get it. I just don't get it. There seems to be still that resistance on the part of companies with entrenched models about surgical products who just don't get what robotics is all about.
I'll submit... They haven't sat down at a console, but they haven't internalized the difference because they still see it as a trick to sort of, a marketing story rather than a true clinical benefit. And, you know, I mean, there's certainly both views, but I think, you know, there's enough people that say there's true clinical benefit.
Okay, I'm pushing the limit here, but let's get to Hansen. So where did the idea for Hansen Medical come about, and why didn't Intuitive do Hansen Medical?
So we had the discussion, and I was, you know, we hired Lonnie. I was the guy that was supposed to look at where we're going rather than what we're doing. And quite frankly, you know, prostates were coming along, but they weren't, you know, they weren't roaring as they are, you know, as they are today. Cardiac surgery was limping along, mm-hmm. and then I got concerned that, you know, we need another, you know, shot at the goal. And the more I pushed on it, the more I got interested in, you know, the advantages of flexible robotics and the procedures that could become targets for flexible technique as opposed to rigid technique. The inherent sort of capability of a flexible with regard robot and flexible access, the routes of access that flexible robotics opened up. So,
in what sense is Hansen a flexible robot and Da Vinci a rigid robot? What do you mean by those two terms?
So we make essentially a catheter that is fully flexible that we control the motion of the tip of. What Intuitive makes is a primarily rigid tool that needs to be targeted to a particular workspace that can be exacting at times. And so the flexibility of a flexible tool is you can introduce it in one place and have it capable of manipulating tissue at a different place. In other words, the freedom of the route of access, which is such that if you want to go through a blood vessel, operate on the heart valve, you're never going to do that with a rigid thing unless you're going to go straight through the chest. And so it opens up the opportunity for a variety of routes of access that you don't have with rigid technique. Mm-hmm.
So we really should open up some questions here. Let me ask one more and then we'll open up for questions here. You've been associated really with being the pioneer in robotics between Intuitive Hansen. We're seeing a mini robotics boom now with Corindus and a bunch of other companies. And you yourself are affiliated with several other robotics companies like Mako, I know, is one of them. Where are we right now in the spectrum of what robotics technology will be able to do in terms of surgical procedures? Are we at the very beginning of the middle, or at the end point? And what do you think a robot will be able to do in the future that it doesn't do now?
Yeah, I think quite frankly, we're at the very beginning of the story of electromechanical control of tools, and whether you call them robots or whatever it is. I think with the progression in electronics, the progression in software, and the capability to automate certain aspects of intervention, I think the sky's the limit with these techniques. And so I really think that modern technology, that robotics is extremely well positioned to take advantage of the progression of electronics and computer technology. And so I think we're going to see largely automated procedures in some cases. Not to say that you're going to take the clinician out of, the position of making the judgment calls of what to do and what not to do, but I think you're going to get a lot of assistance from robotics. And here's why I think that's important. I think that the ability to standardize procedures and to get to as close as you can to having more predictable outcomes is what one aspect of what healthcare needs. And so I think in that sense, people kind of go, that's all, it's technology, it's raising the cost, it's this, that, and the other thing. I'm one that believes in this case, technology can actually decrease the cost of healthcare by increasing standardization of a procedure and, to the extent that you can get there, having much more of a guarantee of a successful outcome and, without the disastrous complications that come from, quite frankly, clinicians that aren't trained well enough, aren't skilled, doing the wrong procedure at the wrong time, or just, make a mistake. So I think the future is extremely bright. And I think, all the problems we see with robotics now, and there's a ton, will incrementally be solved, and I think it's going to have an enormous impact in future techniques in medical therapeutics.
Well, great. Well, Fred, thank you very much. I wish we could go on for another hour here, but we don't have time. Thank you very much, and I'll take some questions from the audience if there are any. Are there any questions? Here's one right here.
Hi. Going back to the beginning, when you first started endotherapeutics, you were taking a research year from your residency program. How did you make that leap of faith to go and start a company rather than stay on with residency?
Yeah, so I actually didn't think I was taking that. I figured I'm going to try this for 6 months. It may blow up in my face, and if it blows up in my face, I'll go back to my residency and become a general surgeon. So it seemed like a really exciting adventure that, you know, I was far enough along in my career so that, you know, I might lose a year or 2 years, but I wouldn't lose the career. I could always sort of re-enter if it turned out to be something very different than I thought it was. So that combined with sort of the passion of, taking an idea to as far as I could get it, was gave me the confidence to leave the residency.
Let me ask one other question before we take another one, and that is, you mentioned before about learning incrementally from some of the other ones. Right now, the future of robotics seems so bright. Intuitive is doing phenomenally well. Hanson is doing well, and there are all these interesting technologies coming up. But when Intuitive was launched, in fact, the history of robotics was really quite
dismal.
Yeah, right. And I'm blanking on the company. This case is here, the RoboDoc.
Integrated Surgical.
What did the first generation robotics companies not do correct
they did everything wrong, absolutely everything wrong. I hate to say it, but it was, they didn't fund it. They got mixed it up with the FDA in a way that they put themselves in the jail and they could never get out of jail. And at the end of the day, it was the same mistakes, some of the same issues we had with Intuitive. It was hard as hell to use, and it wasn't clear that it was doing anything. So it's hard not to fail if you've got that, equation.
Do you think the same is true of computer motion?
What?
Do you think the same is true of computer motion?
Well, I'll contrast it to Mako Surgical, and mm-hmm. I'm not doing an advertisement here, but, it's many years later. They're essentially doing the same sort of thing, only it's easy to use. It's targeted at an audience that's all about, minimally invasive. They're trying to sell the sports medicine. It fits on all, they've funded it well. It fits on all the, they're doing right, everything that RoboDoc did wrong. And plus they were pioneer, quite honestly, RoboDoc was the pioneer.
Right.
You
get to screw up if you're the pioneer.
Yeah. And so it was, really tough sledding that way. Yeah. Much stronger in the States. Europe is still,
But Europe was an early important training ground.
It was an important training ground.
Leipzig.
And it does reasonably well, but it's certainly the penetration is lopsided to the domestic market.
Any other questions? Here's one right here.
Yeah, you mentioned during your presentation the transition from minimally invasive surgery to robots and the lack of tactile feedback technology. Could you elaborate?
Back to
robots.
To tactile feedback?
Correct.
So I can't comment on, their activities today. At the time, it didn't appear from an engineering standpoint feasible, from the standpoint of how to put a force sensor at the tip of a tool and to make it work in a reliable fashion and not sort of break the bank with regard to the cost of the instrument. So just from a technical standpoint, it wasn't a feasible thing back then. And so as I said, you don't get great tactile feedback with conventional laparoscopic tools, but you can tell how hard you're pushing. The bet, as I said, was we need to substitute something for tactile feel, and that turned out to be three-dimensional visualization and the ability to see in three dimensions at a magnified view and appreciate distension of tissue as a substitute for tactile feel turned out to be good enough.
Okay. Let me call that quits. Fred, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
It's been fascinating.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you all this reception outside, and we look forward to seeing you there.
Well, I do wish we had been a-